This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
I am very optimistic that a new leader will emerge next year, and that will change the tide of insecurity we're having now.
That was Isiaka Mustafa, publisher of Abuja-based People's Security Monitor, expressing hopes that Nigeria's next president will be able to ease the rash of brazen attacks across the country. Details coming up. Also, apprehension has gripped Nigeria's capital after the attack by Islamist militants in a prison freed hundreds of inmates. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Scandal-ridden Boris Johnson announced today that he is stepping down as British Prime Minister after he was abandoned by ministers and most of his Conservative lawmakers, bowing to the inevitable as more than 50 ministers quit and lawmakers said he must go. An isolated and powerless Johnson spoke outside 10 Downing Street to confirm he would resign. He said, quote, "The process of choosing the new leader should begin now, and today I have appointed a cabinet to serve as I will until a new leader is in place," end of quote. The Conservatives will now have to elect a new leader, a process which could take weeks or months. Johnson last visited Africa to attend the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Kigali, Rwanda. Apprehension has gripped Nigeria's capital after an attack by Islamist militants on a prison freed hundreds of inmates. The drama further undercut confidence in the government's ability to protect its people and left residents wondering what could happen next. We have more details from Abuja.
The brazen attack on the Kuje Medium Custodial Center complex has driven Nigeria's growing sense of insecurity from attacks around the country right into its political heart. Fear of violence and its economic fallout has spread like wildfire across the sprawling capital. The assault, which has been claimed by Islamic State in West Africa, overwhelmed guards Tuesday night as the insurgents came in large numbers, indiscriminately firing automatic weapons. They swarmed the stone and steel complex, setting free 416 inmates, including Boko Haram militants. Killed in the process were four inmates and an official of the Nigeria Defense Corps on duty that night. 16 inmates have been hospitalized. The government says many of the escapees were recaptured, but all those remained free. Security around the prison has been beefed up, but damage is already done. The U.S. government issued a travel warning to its nationals for 19 states, along with a key road between Abuja and the international airport. That has raised concern about the impact on the economy, already battered by COVID and the fallout of Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
As long as you are a citizen of Nigeria, the insecurity has affected us in different ways, both economic-wise, socially, physically, otherwise, because people now live in fear.
We already know the fact that we have serious insecurity and challenge in the country. I see it as a positive development because it has affected our officials now. They're now directly involved.
Actually, I'm scared. I stay close to Kuje, so I see everybody walking on the road like a criminal. Not as if everybody is, but I had to tighten up my security.
I'm so scared. So now you're leaving here, you're scared. Even at 5 o'clock, I have to go out to pick my children from school. I'm scared.
Voices of some Nigerians in the streets of Abuja narrating their fears on the insecurity situation in the country. The publisher of Abuja-based People's Security Monitor, Isiaka Mustafa, expressed fear that if not well handled, Nigeria's insecurity may affect the 2023 election.
I want to believe that in spite of everything, Nigeria will skate through a general election next year. We are not having it for the first time. Only this time around, we are having it in one of the most horrible way and manner. I am very optimistic that a new leader will emerge next year, and that will change the tide of insecurity we're having now.
Security already was a major issue for the presidential election amidst a rash of attacks on churches, transport and other targets, along with mass kidnappings, with the attackers funding the operations with ransoms. People are asking why the government appears hopeless to stem the violence. President Muhammadu Buhari visited the prison yesterday to assess the damage. He queried its intelligence gathering system and why its defenses failed to work. He has requested a comprehensive report on the incident. For VOA News, from Abuja, Nigeria.
The presidents of the Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda agreed yesterday to de-escalate tensions, but the M23 rebels, whose attack in the eastern DRC sparked the tensions, say they intend to ignore the agreement. Bob Mugabe is a Kigali-based analyst. He tells VOA's Douglas Mpuga that it will take more than peace talks to solve the conflict.
It is more political. It came up with the announcements. They are more political. And up to now, I haven't seen an official communique. I have seen the tweet from the government of Congo, the tweet from the government here, explaining why everything, what happened. But I don't think that they are bringing the right thing. And I don't think that what they have done is Congolese government has accepted to work with the government of Rwanda to track down if there are and to have a joint commission of intelligence officers to share information and also investigate the relationship between FARDC, the Congolese army, and the FDR and the other militia groups who have in one alliance fighting M23. I think what they have agreed is a constant talk, a constant communication, a constant exchanges of information. But when it comes to stopping the fighting in DRC, I think they have to agree on political solution.
Bob Mugabe, he's a political analyst based in Rwanda. My colleague Douglas Mpuga reached him by phone in Kigali. The African Union has called for a probe into hundreds of killings in Ethiopia's western Oromia region. According to the French news agency, AFP, AU Commission Chair Moussa Faki Mahamat is urging that the Ethiopian federal government, as well as regional authorities, to undertake the necessary actions to protect all civilians, including minorities, and ensure that such incidents are prevented. Inter-ethnic violence has been on the rise in recent months in Oromia, the largest and most populous region in Ethiopia. UNICEF officials have told VOA that Ethiopia's drought-stricken population could face a full-blown famine without immediate help. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
UNICEF Ethiopia representative Gianfranco Rotigliano told VOA by phone this week his agency is not receiving the necessary foreign aid to avert a humanitarian crisis. He warned eastern Ethiopia could face a famine triggered by years of drought without the additional help. The country is grappling with the most severe drought it has faced since 1981. UNICEF reports 4 years of failed rains have dried up water sources, led to widespread crop failure, and put an estimated 10 million people on life support, nearly half of them children. The agency said severe acute malnutrition has risen sharply in drought-hit areas. In the Somali region alone, it said there has been a 47% increase. It warned 600,000 children face disease or death without medical and nutritional care. Speaking from Addis Ababa, Rotigliano told VOA he does not have enough money to do what needs to be done.
I'm an old man, and I have been around for many years, and I faced many emergencies in my life. But this is the first time in which I have to face a serious and great emergency, and I don't have the money I need.
He said only $55 million of UNICEF's $351 million appeal to meet increasing humanitarian needs across Ethiopia this year has been received.
In eastern Ethiopia, I have people that don't have drinking water, literally drinking water. So because I don't have money to pay for the trucks, for the fuel, so I think it could blow into a famine if it is ignored.
The UNICEF official said nearly 1.8 million people have been forced to leave their homes in search of water and grazing land for their cattle.
If you travel with livestock and there is no grass, there is no fodder, there is no water, the bush water is dry, the shallow wells are not there anymore, then the camels die, all the animals die.
Rotigliano called on the outside world to send support, but also called for investments needed to mitigate the impact of climate change. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Some Sudanese civil society activists are worried about their country's political future after a military leader, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, said the military will withdraw from UN mediator talks and allow other groups to form a civilian transitional government. The activists say the leadership changes in Sudan have contributed to deteriorating social and economic conditions and worry things could get worse if no political consensus is reached. Youth rights activist Mohamed Shokour told South Sudan in Focus the military coup that al-Burhan led last year interrupted all economic gains made by Sudan since the fall of longtime autocratic president Omar al-Bashir. He says over the past 9 months, military leaders have proven they cannot lead the country and that the government should be handed back to civilians. You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Please note, we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There, you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. Former Burkina Faso President Blaise Compaoré is returning from exile for the first time since he was ousted in a 2014 uprising. According to a Reuters report, Compaoré, who governed Burkina Faso for 27 years, was invited by the ruling military junta to take part in a meeting tomorrow between interim President Paul-Henri Damiba and former President Roch Kabore. The junta overthrew Kabore in January. A presidential statement says the president and former leaders are scheduled to discuss questions linked to the higher interests of the nation. The junta justified its coup by citing rising Islamist violence, but it has been unable so far to slow an insurrection by militant groups linked to Al-Qaeda and Islamic State. Junta leader Damiba has been reaching out to predecessors in recent weeks, emphasizing the need for political unity in the face of the threat. Libya's Tripoli-based presidential council has agreed on a general framework to resolve political deadlock to preserve national unity and the specter of war and halt foreign intervention. Abdel Al-Lafi, deputy head of the three-member council, was charged with holding urgent consultations with political actors to reach an agreement on the details, then lay out a clear roadmap to end the transitional phase via elections. Wolfgang Poschtei, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, discussed the prospects of success of such a framework with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi.
As far as what is known right now, the roadmap is not very detailed yet. The Yellow Vests and other protesters demand from PC chair Mohamed Al-Menfi to disband the House of Representatives, the High Council of State, the two rival parliaments, and both of the rival governments, the Baber and Bashaga government. But for the time being, it seems to be that Al-Menfi is simply either too hesitant or too weak to play a decisive role. Nevertheless, it looks like only the disbandment of all four of these political parties and the appointment of a technocrat interim government or the seizure of power by Libya's Supreme Court could be a way out. if the protests really continue, and we will see this within the next few days. Just a new roadmap with clear tracks and landmarks, as Almenfi said, but without any firm decisions, will probably not be enough to appease the protesters.
But Parliament Speaker Aqila Saleh has accused Mohamed Menfi, the Presidential Council's head, of having some sort of a role in the attack on the Parliament's headquarters in Tobruk last Friday. Saleh's statement come in light of increasing speculation that the Presidential Council may issue a decree to dissolve the House of Representatives and the High Council of State and form a cabinet to prepare for the elections. The HOR Speaker warned that such unilateral measures could lead to more opposition and discord without having a legal or constitutional basis. What's your take on that?
At first, I would like to stress that I don't believe that Almenfi, who comes from the area of Tobruk, is really or was really involved in the ransacking of the parliament headquarters. The statement of Aqila Saleh clearly demonstrates how nervous he is. He is aware that besieger Almenfi is under high pressure from the streets, and he is aware that Almenfi could eventually be pushed to act more decisively and could dissolve the High House of Representatives and the High Council of States. Therefore, Saleh intends to discourage Almenfi and to undermine his credibility right away. Just yesterday, Almenfi met several representatives of political parties and discussed with them the current political situation, the social situation, and the security situation, and possible way out. The representatives urged him to take responsibility. They said there is no other way than, and he must lead the country to immediate presidential and parliamentary elections and to disband the two governments and the two parliaments. To do this, they said also that he needs to reject any international interference, including calls for international monitoring of the use of oil revenues. So this is not only against or helpful with regard to the disbandment of the political bodies, this is also about finding a real Libyan solution without interference from outside.
That was Wolfgang Porstei, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. Botswana is hosting an international meeting aimed at strengthening democracy and adherence to constitutions in Africa. Mokandisi Dube reports from Habrone, Botswana.
The three-day summit organized by Botswana and the US-based National Democratic Institute, NDI, attracted former heads of state and civil society activists from across Africa. Former Niger President Mahamadou Issoufou, speaking via teleconference, says there is concern over the state of democracy in Africa.
We have some satisfactory results from certain countries, but democracy is regressing in certain countries, especially through military coups. I'm happy that Botswana and Niger are speaking with one voice.
Countries have to respect the two-term limit, he adds. Issoufou left office after two terms in 2021 and was awarded the $5 million Ibrahim Prize for good governance. Botswana's president, Mokgweetsi Masisi, says his country, Africa's longest-running democracy, is the ideal location for the meeting. He says Africa requires strong institutions to promote constitutionalism and ensure democracy flourishes.
We remain resolute in the belief that we are better served by strong institutions rather than strong men or strong women or anything in between. My firm belief is that this summit represents our strong partnerships to renew and strengthen efforts to respect constitutional term limits as a pillar of democratic governance and peaceful political transitions across our continent.
Peaceful political transitions remain elusive in some African countries. In the last 16 months alone, leaders have been ousted by coups in Mali, Guinea, Burkina Faso, and Sudan. U.S. Undersecretary for Civilian Security, Democracy and Human Rights, Uzra Zeya, in a recorded statement, said her country would continue to support Africa's efforts to uphold democratic principles.
The United States is proud to support today's convening and will continue to back our partners' efforts to bring attention to the importance of constitutional term limits as they are key to democratic governance. We all know from public opinion research that constitutional term limits have widespread popular support across Africa.
National Democratic Institute President Derek Michel says the Gaborone summit comes at an opportune time.
There's no more important moment to reaffirm and embrace that eternal truth than today, when democracy is under attack in so many corners of the world. Democracy must be protected, defended, cultivated through regular civic practice and education, never taken for granted, and forever refreshed generation after generation. Respect for constitutionalism promotes rule of law and political accountability.
The Gaborone meeting is a follow-up to a 29 summit held in Niger to promote the respect of constitutional limits. Mqondisi Dube for VOA News, Gaborone.
As prices of fuel reach record highs globally, there are growing calls for Africa to transform its markets. Darren Taylor reports.
Global automaker Stellantis last year made the most significant move yet related to electric vehicle manufacturing in Africa. It's producing its super mini electric car, Opel Rocks-e, at a plant near the Moroccan capital of Rabat. In January, Chinese motor manufacturer Dongfeng closed a deal with Egyptian state-owned El Nasser Automotive Manufacturing Company to jointly produce electric vehicles. In international vehicle production circles, there's been chatter about making electric cars in countries including Ghana, Ethiopia, Kenya, and Rwanda. Economics journalist Chepo Mahwai says this talk must turn into action and fast. Otherwise, Africa's motor industry will crumble as international automakers go electric.
So they are using production and sales of internal combustion engines and they are putting it into electric vehicles. I mean, some of the targets set by this automotive industry is 2025, 2030. Ford, for example, they are saying by 2030, all the vehicles sold in Europe will be electric vehicles.
Mahwai says Africa faces catastrophic losses of billions of dollars and millions of jobs if it doesn't move now to transform its car manufacturing capacity. But the CEO of South Africa's Association of Motor Manufacturers, Mike Mabasa, is concerned it's already too late to avoid dark times for continental producers. He says Africa's poorly resourced and has largely not planned for the switch to electric cars.
All the automotive markets around the world, whether you're looking at the United States, looking at Germany, looking at Asia, particularly China, are fully supported by their governments in terms of introduction of programs that assist consumers to be able to do the switch from internal combustion engines.
Mabasa says it's going to take many years for Africa to build capacity to make and use electric cars.
We now have to reinvest in retooling all our manufacturing plants. We need to obviously be able to begin to reinvest in the current capability of our plants because the plants that we are currently having will obviously not be fit for purpose in order to be able to produce electric vehicles. And then, of course, lastly...
Also, he says engineering curriculums at universities have to change.
Is obviously going to be a completely different set of skills that we are going to require for us to be able to make sure that we've got the right people helping us to manage some of the technology that is coming through.
One of the few people in Africa to own an electric vehicle is Johannesburg businesswoman Machepo Sidat. She has only good things to say about her car, saying she charges its battery for 4 hours at home. For her city driving, says Sidat, the battery lasts 3 to 5 days before it needs a recharge. But across Africa, electricity is often scarce. Blackouts are common, even in the continent's most industrialized economy. Despite the so-called load shedding, says Sidat, she still manages to charge her car battery.
You can charge at home. When there is no load shedding, you can put your car in the garage and just plug it into the wall socket. But also there's the charges that you have at the malls as well as the dealerships. Some of the charges, the electric vehicle charges, are actually solar powered. So even when you have load shedding, it does not affect you.
But market analysts say electric car owners in Africa will remain a very small minority for quite some time. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And thanks for choosing The Voice of America.